What a day yesterday. Wasn't that great for those that were here? An amazing series of presentations, and we got more for you today, especially with our leadoff presenter, Jared Bendis from Case Western Reserve University. And Jared, I think, has presented at every NMC conference since the beginning of time. And he always does something that's just slightly off the edge of normalcy, which is what we like. And it's always something interesting. So today, Jared's going to be filling us in on how the future holds no dignity, the death of ethics in the digital age. So take it away, Dr. Bendis.
I'm not Dr. Bendis yet. I'm still just, you know, a guy who, you know, finishes coursework. So thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. I just want to let you know going in that I tend not to look at the IMs as they fly by, so just because it'll derail me, but I will take questions afterwards. So by all means, Alan, pay attention. So I want to start off by going, why am I a Luddite? If you see over my head, it says I'm a Luddite. And the real reason here is because I'm not a futurist. And my presentation is actually not talking about the future. I'm actually talking about the present and the way it leads to an inevitability of, as I see the future, I'd like to see myself today as the ghost of Christmas present. I also want to point out by saying that I am not trying to take the wind out of anybody's sails here. I often give these dark presentations, but I'm not trying to kill any momentum. I actually, please, don't want anyone to think about this. As a colleague once told me, some of us just have different winds. So I want to make sure that I put this in context so you don't go, boy, this guy's really a curmudgeon, because I leave that to the other curmudgeons in the room. A lot of the presentations I know are going to have a strong emphasis on green. Green is not really my thing. I'm not anti-green, by the way. But a lot of these things, when I hear people talking about carbon offsets, kind of bother me. I often don't feel that one bad thing can be offset by one good thing. I think that as an ethical dilemma, I run into a lot of problems with that. I know we talked about Doan Brook came up yesterday in Peter Whitehouse and Mark Cantor's presentation. And I live in the same area. And one of the cooler things that actually came up a couple of years ago was that Cleveland Hopkins Airport wanted to expand. And the only way they could expand the airport was to actually kill 88 acres of wetlands. Now, when they went to kill the 88 acres of wetlands, and there was no way to expand the airport without actually removing the wetlands. And when they went to kill it, the EPA said, well, you're going to need to do something. And they actually said, okay, well, let's do something about restoring Doan Brook and to help for it. Now, while the plan eventually fell through for other reasons, one of the things that I found very artificial about this is that Doan Brook and Cleveland Hopkins Airport are about as far away as possible from each other in the city of Cleveland. So literally, and there were protests about this. There were literally, you're going to screw up one part of Cleveland and make pretty another part of Cleveland. And so you've sort of got this artificial, you know, political structure of what a city is. And then, of course, you've got, but we're doing something good along the same way. So I actually recently heard a George Carlin routine, obviously it's an older routine, where he was saying that when people talk about saving the planet, it's really self-serving, because no matter what we really do, the planet will go on. It may not be habitable for human life, but the planet will go on. So that when we talk about saving the planet, we really are talking about saving our asses on the planet. And so I want to get back to our discussion of ethics to here. And this is why I don't want to look, I want to look backwards a little bit, not necessarily forward. Now, a lot of times when I give talks, I don't have any projects to show whatsoever. I'm just sort of ranting. And while this is one of those rants, I will actually try to talk about some personal projects that I'm working on. And yes, I know I'm often the voice of doom. Now, one of the things that I think really kind of got my goat recently, and I'm going to talk about some of the recent things that I've been seeing in the media, is Kanye West at the VMA Awards. And I will look for a moment at the chat window to see, is everyone aware what happened at the Video Music Awards with Kanye West? Yep, 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 yep. Wow, look at all those yeses. Thank God. Not a clue. So here's what ended up happening. Taylor Swift won for Video of the Year, and Kanye West got up and pretty much, you know, while she was giving her talk, as one person said, stomped on a kitten. But what he did was he took the microphone and then said that Beyonce's video was better. Now, this was a horrible video clip, and I'll actually give a bunch of links later on if you want to take a look at it. And the reason I mentioned this, and people go, oh, well, everyone knows that Kanye is a jerk and Kanye does this, that isn't what really bothers me. What bothers me is about the culture that we live in that allows things like this to happen. For instance, where was production? There are people in control rooms. I guarantee you that if any of the microphones started getting feedback at the time, if any of the microphones are getting feedback, they would be all over lowering those mics, getting the speakers in good play. But when Kanye hijacked her moments, where was the production to turn the volume down? And the problem is the production was like, well, it's a good media moment. We'll go for it. So there's a complicity that gets involved in this. And later on, somebody said, well, you can't blame the man for speaking his mind. Well, actually, you can, because it wasn't his moment. Now, later on, Beyonce was really generous, and she brought Taylor Swift back out. And Taylor Swift was probably the most gracious of all of them, because after the event, entering an interview, she is quoted as saying, I was really excited because I'd won the award, and then I was excited because Kanye West was on the stage, and then I wasn't so excited anymore. And she never said anything, you know, horrible about him at all, and all the way through. And I say I blame Twitter culture for a lot of this, but I'm going to get back to why I say culture and not Twitter itself. Because the next day, or on Monday, Jay Leno was scheduled to have Kanye on as a musical guest. And what I found very disturbing about this, they were going to have Kanye on, that's not a problem. The problem was because of the controversy surrounding the event, what they ended up doing was they ended up letting him sit down with Jay so that he could do a, I'm so sorry, I'm such a bad person, have Jay beat him up. And my problem is what the hell has happened to people? There was a time when if you did something horrible and terrible, and everyone agreed was horrible and terrible, they would cancel you. They get off. We don't want you here. But that, of course, isn't the point. The point is they wanted the sensationalism, that they wanted it. I mean, obviously, can they blame Jay Leno? He needs the ratings. But we're building this culture where right and wrong is very strange. I actually recently wrote an article on one of my blogs about the Reverend Wright interview that came out not too long ago, where he was quoted when the Daily Press asked Reverend Wright, have you seen Obama since you got elected? And he was quoted as saying, them Jews ain't going to let him talk to me. Now, again, what Reverend Wright says doesn't matter to me. What matters to me was when listening to the interview, there was a gap in the tape. And I went back and I listened to an unedited version of the tape. And the unedited version of the tape has David Squires, who's the interviewer, saying Wright and then laughing with him. And they edited it out. They removed it. They censored it themselves because they knew it was wrong, but then they kept it going. So there are some issues here of not... sort of, I don't expect more from Kanye. I don't expect more from Reverend Wright. What I expect more from is the organizations out there that pretend that they're not part of these stories when they're complicit in it. And in some ways, we're complicit in it as well. And when I start talking about this, one of the things I like to say is technology isn't evil. I want to go out on the record and say I feel that technology isn't evil at all, and I feel that Tufte is wrong. I think people are wrong. I think people tend to be evil. People make mistakes. Technology affords us to be able to look into the worst parts of ourselves at times. As you know, if you take a rat and you wire an electrode to the pleasure center of the brain, they will click it until they die. Well, we are those rats, and we are finding really new, interesting ways of hooking up electrodes to our brains, and we are going to click it till we die, and we're part of those people responsible to sort of navigate it. The technology isn't evil, but everything else around it sort of does it. I want to give you another quick example and about why the Twitter culture, as people are calling it, is bothering me, and that, of course, is the recent in a recent survey of 200 teenagers by the Boston Public Health Commission concerning Chris Brown and Rhiannon, 46% of the teenagers said that Rhiannon was responsible for what had happened in the fight, and that 52% said that they shared the responsibility, even though they know that Rhiannon's injuries ended up taking her to the hospital. So the idea about everyone having a voice isn't really a problem. It's just everyone acknowledging that everybody's voice is right is the problem, and it's sort of a lowest common denominator of a voice. Point of view doesn't make it correct. Recently, and some of these examples, by the way, may hit home to some people, so please don't kill me until afterwards. I recently had a friend I was consulting with. I was helping him do his website, and he had went out and bought, for instance, Johnson's and Associates LLC.com. This isn't the actual one, by the way. It's an example. And so he goes out and buys Johnson's Associates LLC, and I tell him it's a horrible domain name. And he goes, why? And I said, well, let's take a look at it from this perspective. Who are your associates? And he goes, I don't have any associates. I said, okay, great. So the first thing you've told me is the name of your company is a lie. So you want to make it look like you're bigger than you are. So you go out and the first step forward is Johnson's & Associates LLC. You're a liar. What does LLC mean? He goes, well, I'm a limited liability corporation. I go, what does that do? And he goes, well, it makes it harder for them to sue you. It means that, you know, that if somebody can sue you, they can't go after your personal assets because you're a limited liability corporation. So great. So your first presence on the web is to say, hi, I'm a liar who it's difficult to sue. Is that really who you want to be? And yet most people, of course, are too self-centered. They're looking at it from their perspective, not from the other people's perspective. Over the High Holy Days, I went to temple. Yes, I was at temple. And the rabbi got up and he gave a great quote. And he was talking about this. And he said that in the article Generation Me in Time Magazine by Raina Kelly, one of the quotes he found was, treating the whole world as if it works for you doesn't suggest you're special. It means you're an ass. And I thought that was a great quote. And I was so excited. And I was going to go home, and I knew I was going to use it in this talk. So I went home, and of course, I'm not just going to quote my rabbi. I'm going to look up the quote. And matter of fact, he actually went, and he sent us a copy of his sermon. And it says, Raina Kelly in Time Magazine. Well, guess what? It's in Newsweek. So what does it mean that my rabbi says the article is in Time Magazine instead of it being in Newsweek? What it means is he didn't see the article. What it means is he quoted a quote. He didn't do his due diligence. Not only didn't he do his due diligence, he actually sent us a copy of it. I actually look up quotes before I use them. I have references for everything I'm talking about here. And again, I'll post links later on if you'd like. So the problem with this is, and I love the quote. Well, the problem with this is that one big snafu changes the whole discussion. Right? So I want to change the discussion back to the more important discussion, the bigger issues. So when I hear these little things, you know, my rabbi has a great quote, that's great. But then my rabbi, I realize, isn't actually, you know, doing his research. Now I want to talk about the fact that my rabbi isn't doing his research. And people are like, oh, well, you got to forgive the guy. Really? I expect him to be the pinnacle of ethics and research. Let me give you another example of how one snafu can change the discussion. My wife's favorite movie is Breakfast at Tiffany's. Quick show in the audience. How many of you have seen Breakfast at Tiffany's? Breakfast at Tiffany's. Yay, yay. Excellent. How many of you would show it in class? It's hard to show it in class today. Mickey Rooney. Thank you, Derek. That's right. Mickey Rooney plays an Asian character in the movie. It is a negative stereotype. It is completely crazy. Matter of fact, you can't show the movie in class without it all of a sudden turning into a discussion of Mickey Rooney playing an Asian person, and that's not what you want the conversation to be about. More importantly, recently I was putting together my curriculum for next semester's new media literacy course, and I wanted to make sure that I had spelled A.K. Dewdney's name right, and I didn't have one of his books laying around. A.K. Dewdney is an author. He used to write mathematical observation articles for Scientific American. He actually took over Martin Gardner's column. Great column. And I have a lot of his books and stuff like that. And anyway, I went to look him up, and there it was. I spelled his name correctly. And as I'm looking at the Wikipedia article on him, just, you know, as an observation, it also says that he's a primary author of 9/11 alternate theory materials. And now I'm stuck, because somebody who I am a big hero of is basically a conspiracy nut who believes that the planes landed, other planes took off, and that it was a military-based operation. Matter of fact, he's one of the all people behind physics911.net. And it scares the crap out of me, because can I use this guy's articles that I like, that are interesting, from the 80s, when I won't go anywhere near his articles from the last decade? And it makes me, and I could ignore it. And people go, well, you can like Roman Polanski movies, but I'm also not asking Roman Polanski to babysit anybody for me. And I know that's harsh, but he was convicted. So the issues here have to do with the fact that I have to now inform my students. I can't let my students discover it on their own. I can't, ignore the fact that he's, whatever. So I want to make sure that we actually talk about everything, that all of these things that are looking at. And it actually has hurt me a little bit, because I was actually building a couple of interesting websites. I was going to be building a joke website called smokingcurescancer.com. Or if you go to petduplicators.com, I was making a joking, humorous pet cloning website. But there are too many serious pet cloning websites that prey on the innocent, that really, really hurt people, that I couldn't actually go into those things. So it really, really bothers me. What also bothers me is the level of hubris that we look at when we're looking at the way we work with technology today. Let me give you a question. And I'm going to ask this question real fast. Does anybody know the name of the tallest building in the world ever to be purposefully torn down, or what's in the business lawfully demolished? Does anybody know the name of the tallest building in the world ever to be torn down? All right, everybody, stop looking it up. For those of you who are going to Wikipedia or to Google to look it up, stop looking it up. I didn't ask you to look it up. I asked you if you know, not if you knew how to find it out. A lot of people do this. In my classes, they do this all the time. They jump in and they go, I know how to find the answer. That means I know the answer. No, it doesn't. So I want you to realize that strategies of looking does not mean knowledge yet in your life. Well, since everyone doesn't know, thank you, the tallest building ever demolished lawfully was the 47-story Singer Building. It was built in 1908. It was demolished in 1968. That's right, folks. Think about it. Since 1968, no building taller than 47 stories has ever been torn down lawfully. There's been two buildings that have been destroyed. And you think about it from this perspective. Everyone wants to know where it is. I've got a link. It's the Singer Building. I've got a link somewhere. I'll pop it in, unless Alan wants to pop it in for me. I got it. There we go. I looked it up. So anyway, so the real question is, if you can imagine this, 47 stories tall, tallest building ever lawfully destroyed, we are building buildings every single day. Every single day that are bigger than this. And we have no exit strategy. We have no exit strategy for our architecture, for our brick and mortar architecture. We have no idea how to take these buildings that have limited lives, that are dying, and remove them. Think about just the sheer arrogance of that. And then think about the arrogance of what we're doing with our technology. We keep pretending that nothing's going to happen. There's an interesting thing in Judaism where they actually make a distinction between stealing, between theft and burglary, between robbery and theft. And the reason they make this distinction is because they say that somebody who steals openly has no fear. If I'm a robber and I steal from you, I don't fear man and I don't fear God. But if you steal from someone in the middle of the night and you sneak into their house, there's something disrespectful about that, because you believe that God isn't, that you're only afraid of man, but you're not afraid of God. And they love that distinction. And whether or not you are religious or not, there's almost a distinction of whether you're afraid of the rules or you're afraid of the enforcer, whether you're afraid of the rules or you're afraid of getting caught. And I'm going to return to this later. And if I take a moment to look backwards, I'd like to tell you right now that I wake up every day and I firmly believe that we live in a dystopia. That this is no science fiction future that I'm afraid of. I am terrified by the present. I'm terrified by the present because let's go back. Let's do a thought exercises. Let's go back into the mid-80s before a lot of us were online, or the late 80s when several of us were online. You know, back then, the concept that your email would be, or that your primary mode of communication would be plagued by garbage, that nothing we do, that most of what we do isn't archivable, and the concept that might makes right as policy, and that's where we live. Think about walking into a library of the future. That you walk in the library of the future and it's filled with garbage, and half the books will explode in your face if you don't pull the right one off the shelf. This is where we live right now. You know, we are drowning in garbage. And then we say, oh, but let's look forward. You know, we talk about, I want to start with the lack of archivability. I mean, yesterday we mentioned a little bit the death of GeoCities, you know, but, you know, people, you know, well, yes, people weren't really using it. One of the great articles was called So Long GeoCities, We Forgot You Still Existed. But there are people out there who had stuff on there. You know, it may not be, oh, everything important is being archived. Really? I don't necessarily know that that's true. And so there are things that are going away. I often talk about, as a stereo photographer, that at the end of the 19th century, the number one medium in the world was 3D photography, and that medium has pretty much vanished. We have seen mediums vanish. Analog television as a medium lasted less than 100 years. So we can't be so arrogant as to think that our good storage space is actually going to make it. We are making things that we have that won't last 5 years, let alone whether they're archivable. Facebook recently was talking about the fact that they're creating these memorial profiles. If somebody dies, that they'll memorialize them. I had a friend who recently died, and there was a discussion about, you know, what do you do with their email? What do you do with their accounts? All the forums they're on. You know, that sense about that death footprint is very weird, and it's happening. Another interesting phenomenon I think that we've seen over the past 20 years is the concept of beta as a release version. Now, we know this happens in software all the time, you know, first to market, so who cares if it doesn't work right? Let the users fix it for us. I don't know if you've seen this one, but recently in higher education, the American Psychological Association released their 6th edition. I'm actually going to post this one in, but the 6th edition of the APA style guide was so plagued with errors that there are so many corrections. And there's the first printing was horrible. The second printing, I guess, fixed them all. But the real issue with all of this is, you know, people were like, oh, I want my money back. I want another book. And they're like, well, we're not giving you another book. And you're like, but the product was faulty. The product was broken. No media is correct. This is about culture. This is not about technology. This is about the fact that we are, as a society, sort of losing touch with a lot of what we're doing. People are confusing filters for progress. I asked my wife the other day how much spam she gets every day, and she said, oh, I don't get spam every day. My spam filters do a good job. Filters are good, but imagine for a moment that you went to the grocery store and all of the food was rotten, and you had to pay somebody to help you pick the good food. That's what we're looking at. I don't want to see filters out there. I want to see the crap end. Now, a couple of years ago, I told my boss I wanted to form a cult. He asked me what I stood for, and I told him that I stood for good customer service. And with that in mind, we actually started the website theystolemydignity.com. It's really just a blog where I rant about horrible customer service stories. But recently, my horrible customer service stories have been pale in comparison to my spam worries. My spam is just killing me. I get angry at spam. I'm not talking about the Viagra spam. I'm talking about spam from companies that should know better. I mean, I get emails from companies that should know what they're doing and are in violation of the Can Spam Act. And I'll talk about some of those requirements in a second if you're not aware of them. But I basically started up a new blog, and the new blog is called whatthehelliswrongwiththem.com. And I invite you to take a look at that at some point, where I post some pretty awful stories. I want to give you a case study about Doritos. Recently, I got an email from Doritos. It was an interesting email. And one of the quotes from it was, give your students a chance to be featured on one of the biggest TV advertising stages, the Super Bowl. Now, interestingly enough, it said, give your students a chance, which means they were targeting me as a teacher. So they got my name off a list somehow. But what I found was interesting about it was it did not actually have an opt-out email anywhere on it. Now, you are, by the way, legally allowed to solicit from people one time as long as there's an opt-out message in it and as long as the header is good. You can't blind carbon copy people a solicitation that's actually not valid. So I was really upset because obviously I didn't see the opt-out email. And then I went to the website, which we'll talk about in a second, which again was a nightmare. It was very self-serving, even though they want me to have my students go there. So I was very upset about this, and I look, and they're using a goddamn Yahoo email address. Literally, the email came from Yahoo.com. Yahoo.com! How could a legitimate company use a Yahoo.com email address? So I actually reported them to Yahoo.com, and of course I skewered them on my website, and then I actually sent them, their real people, an email. And interestingly enough, I got a response from Doritos. The response was, I work for Doritos and wanted to reach out to apologize for this. Whenever we send out communications like this, we try to include an opt-out function, and unfortunately, the third party we work for in this promotion forgot to include it. You know what? That doesn't excuse them. You know, their website, which they really begged me to get my students involved. How can I send my students to get involved in a contest that doesn't know what the ethics, even what the laws for this stuff is these days? By the way, it's a loud, obnoxious, flashy website that is filled with misinformation and encourages people, students, to do things that are against their own interest. An example is when you submit your videos, they want you to submit them early, so that you can generate buzz, when the professionals will tell you you don't want to submit your video until the last minute so that people can't copy or steal from you. So it's a nightmare. I recently, of course, got a similar email from Canon. When I unsubscribed from Canon, they said that they would get to it. The next day, I got another email from Canon. When I went to unsubscribe again, I found that everything had been unchecked. So they knew I had subscribed, but they hadn't updated their database yet. That doesn't make any sense. It's what I call legal but bullshit. This happens all over the place, and there's very little that we can do here to be able to fix this. I recently sent an email out to one of these spam violators as follows. I just want to point out several items to you. Dear unsolicited emailer, you just sent me an email in violation of the 2003 CAN Spam Act. I just want to point out several items. Number one, by emailing using a BCC or an alias, you have used false or misleading header information. In fact, I can't even tell which of my emails you're trying to correspond with. Two, we have no existing relationship. I've neither purchased from you nor I have subscribed to this mailing list. Any relationship that you have with my company does not entitle you to randomly email me. Three, even if I had, your email contains no information on how to opt out of future emails from you. A reminder that simply deleting me from your current mailing list does not constitute compliance, as once I've requested opted out, you must retain this information and not email me in the future. And you are responsible for the actions of third-party marketing organizations. Violation, by the way, is a subject of a penalty of up to $16,000 per email. But who are these people going after? Who does the FTC go after? They go after the big spammers. You know what? They should go after the little guys. Let me tell you something. If all of a sudden, you know, one by one, these little companies start getting $16,000 fines, you see a lot fewer companies trying at it. And by the way, there's a great thing that we can do. Let's end free email accounts. Let's kill free email. I'd actually love to see government-regulated, authenticated users. Now, some people are going to go, oh, my God, the government, they'll screw it up. Sure, they'll screw it up. But we're screwed up already. Sorry. We're screwed up already. You know what we're seeing instead? You know what we're seeing instead is we're seeing websites out there going, you can log in using Facebook authentication. Great. So Facebook wants to become the de facto authenticated user. Twitter wants to be the de facto authenticated user. But there's nothing that prevents me from making fake Facebook and Twitter accounts. So all that does is empowers Facebook with this fake sense of reliability. By the way, I created a fake Facebook account recently. I'll explain why. And I just started out by going to a few groups, joining them. Nothing where it said, please add me groups. They were just a few targeted groups. And I added a few friends every day. And every day, people add me. I have over 1,300 Facebook friends, and I don't know any of them. So you can't look at it like, oh, well, Facebook is going to be the new authentication of the future. We are living right now in a culture of violations that prey on the innocents. 60 Minutes last week talked about a report that the worst cereals are the most heavily marketed to kids. And, you know, last week something else happened. I don't know if you saw this, but Soupy Sales died. Did everyone see that Soupy Sales died? I felt really bad about this. Some of you were like, wasn't he already dead? you know, one of the most famous Soupy Sales stories is that he, on a New Year's broadcast one day, he ad-libbed at the end of his thing, and he told kids to sneak into their parents' wallets and pull out those little green pieces of paper and mail them to him. He didn't, by the way, get a lot of money, though it was a big controversy at the time. And, of course, the joke about the idea of him sending the money was they were saying, well, he was just being direct. I mean, instead of saying, kids, ask your mom to send me money, he just said, kids, send me the money. Now, when I talk about this preying on innocence, for instance, here's another question, folks. How many of you play Mafia Wars? I moved on from Mob Wars. How many of you play Mafia Wars? Facebook? Nope, 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 nope. Wow. None of you. Don't get started. Ness? Anyway, let's talk about it. It's an interesting thing because a lot of these games out there, it's addicting. Yes. This isn't, by the way, an example. It's addicting. It actually uses slot machine conditioning. For instance, I don't know if you're familiar with the Pavlovian response, is, you know, if you ring a bell and you give a dog a treat, they'll start to salivate. And if you keep doing this, keep giving him the treat, he'll keep salivating. Eventually, if you ring the bell without a treat, the dog will salivate. But if you ring the bell enough times without giving the dog a treat, the conditioned response will extinguish. So you can create the response and you can extinguish the response. Let's go in the other direction for a moment. If you go the other direction, you go to a slot machine. What is the win of a slot machine? It's not money, folks. It's the bell. It's the whistle. It's the whistle. It's the rush. It's the excitement of seeing it happen. And the trick is, in slot machine psychology, is the only way to guarantee you to feel that rush again is to play faster, to play more. The faster you play at a slot machine, the more often you will see the short-term reward because your brain can't perceive the long-term reward. And when you look at games, when we look at games like Mafia Wars, where they literally put time on one side and reward on the other, and they're simply clicking games. There's very little, there's some strategy, but not enough strategy to make it worth your while. What it is it preys into our deepest seated, obsessive, compulsive, natural tendencies. And then it takes a little bit of money off the top. And they know this and they do this. And so the idea is that they're machining us. And more importantly, we are hitting a really strange wall. It's the machine versus doing everything we want anytime we want. Let me look at it from this perspective. How many of you have gotten a speeding ticket from a traffic camera? Yep. Oh, no. I hate traffic speeding tickets. I think it's wrong. I wish it was illegal, Cynthia. I wish it was here. I think it's absolutely wrong because the premise is this. The premise is that the machine is judging a human. See, at least with a machine judging a machine, I'll go with that. But it's a human should judge a human. I've got no chance of talking my way out of that ticket. I've got no chance of discussing it. So the idea about there's the machine on one side, you know, I'm sorry, but I can't help you with that customer service problem. I'm sorry, but I'm not allowed to do that. I'm sorry, but it's that we are building these little machines on one side. And on the other side, we are building these machines that let us do everything we want to do. We think about the fact that we're building this strange, it's a culture of lying, it's a culture of freedom. I met a kid the other day who had a barcode tattoo on his arm, and I asked him what the barcode was of, and he didn't know. His mother was with him, and I said, have you ever thought about taking him to Walmart and swiping him to see what his barcode's of? Wouldn't it be funny if the tattoo artist gave you, like, you know, a barcode about tampons? And here's a guy who put a barcode on it, he's got no idea what it means. He also doesn't know what it means to barcode yourself, the culture of oppression, you know, that moral compass, the ethical compass. You know, some people know that I've had issues with Second Life and some of Linden Lab stuff in the past. And I actually don't want to talk about that. What I want to talk about is back in the day when you could gamble in Second Life, my issue wasn't necessarily that you could gamble. I'm actually not averse to gambling. I love gambling. My aversion to the fact that it was unregulated gambling. There was nothing about the early days of Second Life that would prevent me from creating a slot machine that never paid off. The technology wasn't evil. It was the implementation of that technology. I could make a website where people, you know, pay me and nothing ever happens. I looked into this. I was looking at one of the early con artists. There was a guy who lived up in Alaska who actually set up a telegraph store. He set up a telegraph system. There was no telegraph. People would pay to send telegrams, and there were no wires. They would just pay him. There's another thing that's been happening right now. Look at Google. They would like an exemption of copyright law because they're big, because the project is cool. They think that they should be exempt from it because of their size. Now, everyone's talking about the Google one, but I don't know if you saw the one yesterday where Pepsi was just found guilty of a $1.6 billion judgment because they didn't show up in court. They were sued. They didn't show up in court, and they had a judgment against them for $1.6 billion. And they've recently asked the court, quote unquote, to excuse the corporate bureaucracy that buried the legal document for weeks. Somebody made a mistake. You know what? That's bullshit. If I make a mistake and don't show up for court, nobody says, "Well, I understand, Jared. Your wife misplaced the summons." So Pepsi might not. But Pepsi's saying because we're so big, we deserve an excuse. That doesn't work that way. You know, there's a real problem with this. And Pepsi said, quote unquote, the $1.26 billion judgment that has been entered is unprecedented in size and justice requires that PepsiCo have a chance to defend itself. You know what, folks? You had a chance to defend yourself. You didn't. That was your chance. But it boils down to something really harsh and especially important when it comes to the internet and network technologies, that ethics doesn't scale. And I'm going to say that morality doesn't scale. Size is the enemy. Years ago, I used to be I play guitar. And if you were looking for good sheet music, you would go onto Usenet and you go, anybody know the chord progression for whatever? And of course, people would, give you chord progressions. And then, of course, when the web really happened, what you saw was somebody created the Online Guitar Archive, also known as Olga. And Olga was great because you could look up a song. The problem is that Olga went down with copyright problems. And interestingly enough, the copyright problems with Olga was not the chord progressions, because chord progressions, by the way, aren't covered by copyright, though tablature is, folks. Olga went down because of the lyrics. The lyrics are under copyright. And so what they ended up doing was they ended up going back, and they would have the first few words, dot, 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 the second few words, dot, dot, dot. And they found a solution to their problem. And it's a very clever solution. But the problem is this. I can sit around a coffee shop and swap notes with my buddies, but when I get bigger, it's no longer my buddies. My buddies can't be the world. The idea of right and wrong doesn't necessarily scale the way it should. There was you can find lyrics elsewhere now. Now, let's talk about another interesting situation. There was a kid who set up a lemonade stand, but because of the way their street was configured, they set the lemonade stand up not in front of their house, but on a local street corner. And one of the city workers, whose job was, by the way, to do business compliance, was driving down the street and saw this lemonade stand, and he shut him down. And people were like, what a bastard. How could he do that? Because it's his job. What if everybody started putting up lemonade stands? You know, there have been recent questions about how they could give this to children. The cities were talking about creating business exemptions just for children. But like, my neighbors have a garage sale every week, and they're not selling their home items. They're having they've turned their front yard into a store. The idea of these things scaling is a problem. We can make an exemption here or there, but exemptions become a human issue, and when exemptions become the rule, they're no longer exemptions and we get chaos. And that's the problem that we run into. I dream of a day where viruses are eliminated, where spam is eliminated, where scam artists are eliminated. And don't think this can't happen. This could happen. Of course, the way to do this would be to basically create a black ops team that would go around and shut these people down. Yeah, I'm really – you didn't know what part of the scale I was on in Ruben's talk yesterday, did you? I'm a real bastard about this. We know who these people are. We can stop them. We choose not to. We think that going after the world's biggest spam artist is the problem. I emailed Yahoo. I said, Yahoo, these people, Doritos, Frito-Lay, a major corporation, sent me a spam that is in clear violation of the Can't Spam Act. And they emailed me back saying they would take care of it, but they would not tell me how the item resolved itself. And you know what? The email's still in business. They're still using the Yahoo.com email address. So now I've got to go to the FTC, and the FTC will do nothing. So all I get to do is skewer these people publicly. And you know what? Hopefully every little time we embarrass a known corporation, the known corporations are the ones I worry about. And every time we do this, hopefully we change people's attitudes. You know, I keep looking at the lessons for the future, and I keep thinking about John Lennon. You know, imagine no possessions. And then I keep thinking that the next line would be, and no subscriptions too, right? I'm losing my possessions, and what I end up doing is end up subscribing to things, right? I don't own anything. I'm owning less than I did, and I'm paying more than I did forever. This one guy I know keeps trying to hack into one of my WordPress accounts. He keeps trying to hack into my account. I've got his email address. Google's not going to do anything about this guy's Gmail address. You know, I always been asking people recently, who polices the movie theater? I don't know if you've been to the movies recently and you see like people texting or making noise. Turns out one of our local movie theaters will allow you to actually take a pager with you. And if there's a commotion in the theater, you can page a manager to come in the theater and take a look to see what's going on. But I'm not talking about policing movie theaters or even policing the internet. I'm talking about policing people. This is about people. We don't need more vigilantes, Larry. But we do need to police the people. We do need to figure out a way. Now, the FTC came out recently and talked about bloggers revealing whether or not they're getting freebies. But, of course, that isn't going to change much. Interestingly enough, I'm seeing an increased fear of cameras, probably more than we ever used to. I mean, really, an increase of – I pull out a camera and people duck. And they duck not because they're afraid of their picture being taken. They're afraid of where their picture is going to end up. And even worse, they're afraid of the fact that they feel that they won't be able to do anything about it if it gets online. I recently did an art project at a festival where I invited people to tell me a joke. And I didn't think anybody would tell me a dirty joke. I actually figured that people would, tell me all clean jokes. I would say about a third of the jokes were filthy. And they knew that I was going to be putting them online. They even signed waivers. I make people sign waivers. So if you can go look at them, by the way, at sillyservices.com if you're interested in watching these some good, some bad jokes. Now, I do want to skip ahead a little bit because I think that we need to remember that we're the people who invented the bots and the agents that roam the web and join our groups and spam our worlds. We make these smart – every time you have to type in like a picture verification code, that's because we made our bots too smart. Now we're seeing people do it the other way around. We're seeing people ask questions instead. So it's kind of being strange this way. I want to end with two little bizarre little stories. You may have heard the story about the rock group and the brown M&Ms. This is not an urban legend. It actually happened. In the Van Halen rider, it said that no brown M&Ms could be backstage. This was basically just a check to find out whether or not they read all of the other technical descriptions. And the simple way of finding out whether the technical descriptions were read was if they went backstage and saw brown M&M, they pretty much meant that the stage requirements weren't going to be met either. And that's actually a true story. And it's the same sort of situation. We're trying to verify that a real person did a real thing. I want people to think like users, and I want you to remember a couple of things on my way out. Most PDFs aren't green. For those of you who are making PDFs and thinking that you're being all green, you're not. The next time you make a PDF, ask yourself, did I format it as an 8.5x11 document? Because every time you see somebody format a PDF as an 8.5x11 document, they're saying, print me. If you don't want me to print the document, format it for my screen. Most PDFs are printed. By the way, when you put something online and you say, here is it on PDF, or here you can read it on the web, which foot are you putting forward? Don't put the PDF first. Put your web-based version first. Think like a user. Be responsible about these things. And more importantly, we need people telling us whether it's a good idea or it's a bad idea. I'm going to end with this last little story. There's a story of a famous of a CEO, and he's in a business meeting with another CEO. And at the end of the business meeting, the one CEO turns to the other and says, "Excuse me, sir, your fly is open. Just wanted to let you know." And his entire staff, by the way, saw that his fly was open, but nobody wanted to be the one to be embarrassed enough to tell the boss that his fly was open. So he fired his staff because they were more embarrassed. They were more worried about their own embarrassment than the greater good. So our job is to point out the problem. We must point out the problems. We must fix the problems. We must look out for the other guy. We cannot pretend that it is not our problem. That's how we got here in the first place. So on that note, I encourage us to fix the present and be careful that we don't F up the future while we're at it. Any questions?
Thank you, Jared. Let's fix the present, everybody. How are we going to do that, folks? Tell Jared how we should fix the present. I'm not sure about giving over my government, my email to the government, but
I'm not telling you they should give over your email to the government. I'm saying that we should be. If I knew with definitiveness that you were you, then you would do less bad. Hiding is not a good thing for people. Standing up for yourself. I don't allow my students anonymity. The real world, you say it, you stand up for it, and you can't unsay it.
All right, well, let's give Jared Bendis a big hand for giving such a great talk without a single slide.